Welcome to The Mockingcast, the podcast of Mockingbird Ministries. I'm David Zoll, your host, and in a few moments, I'll be joined by my co-hosts, Sarah Condon and RJ Heyman. We come to you every other week to discuss a few of the places where we currently see grace and its absence playing out in unexpected and compelling ways. We're glad to have you with us.
Praise the Lord.
Well, hey, everyone, welcome. We're to the Mockingbird Conference. It hasn't really started yet, but this is our pre-conference podcast taping. We haven't done this in 4 or 5 years, at least, since before the pandemic.
Yeah.
And when we last did it, we were in the chapel, so it's fun to do it in here where we can really hear our words echo off the walls. Well, thank you for coming. We're going to just do what we normally do when we record a podcast, except for in front of you. But then at the end, we're going to try to do a Q&A. So if you have, you know, insults or comments or questions, or you want to hear RJ sing or something like that, just know that you're going to get your opportunity. If it's terrible, we'll just cut it and never broadcast it. But all right, here we go. How are you guys doing?
Great.
Good.
Glad to be here.
Yes. Tell us more. How's your last couple weeks been?
Well, I'm here with my best friend in the whole wide world, Lindsay Clemens, and we've already eaten like 4 different meals today and spent all of the money that I will make this weekend shopping, which has been really fun. So yeah, I'm glad to be here.
Perfect.
Yeah, it's fun to be back in New York. You know, I've lived here 14, 15 years between middle school. My 2 oldest boys were born here. Bumped into a dad from one of their schools on the street, which was kind of wild. So just nice to walk around. Beautiful weather, too. Can be rainy sometimes this time of year. So it's been really fun.
Yeah, there was definitely like a solid 5-year stretch of Mockingbird.
Yes.
In the rain.
Yeah.
In the rain. And if you know anything about this building, it's a wonderful building. We're so grateful to Calvary, and this is St. George's Church, for hosting us. But kind of infrastructure in Manhattan of old church buildings, it's just not simple.
No.
There was one year when it started raining, and all of a sudden just like...
Drips coming from the ceiling.
Not just drips.
Not drips.
No, like, no, okay, it was pouring
like
pouring down.
Like a flood.
Good. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Good.
And we won't even talk about the bathrooms.
But Jacob Smith, the rector, climbed up on the roof.
No, he did not.
Yes, he did, in a suit, to fix the problem with the water.
That's
so,
New York also, City rector for you right
I know,
there.
Tough as nails.
Nothing he can't do.
That dude. Well, we joked about last episode that this is handmade, and people are about to experience that in all its glory. I had a big birthday.
Oh, yeah. Happy birthday, Dave.
Our last recording in this one. I'm halfway to 90.
Wow.
Wow.
You're old.
Halfway to 90.
Yeah.
So I'm way past my quarter life crisis. I think I'm almost past my midlife crisis. I'm still in the middle of it a little bit, but the quarter life crisis, do you guys feel like you went through a quarter life crisis?
I drive a convertible, so maybe. I've definitely moved more than I would ever wish on anyone. And I think every time you pick up your family and move someone hundreds of miles away and have to find new doctors and new housing and new schools, and causes you to evaluate your life choices. So maybe. Mm. I think I had a religious crisis early on in my 20s when I was trying to do everything perfectly, you know? And then your father was very helpful. He's like, no, that's not the gospel. That's the law. There's a reason you're feeling the way you're feeling. And that kind of saved my life and my ministry. Mm. But I don't know. We'll see what happens. Apparently 47, 48 is like statistically the least happy time in anyone's life.
So Dave, there's that's still what they, time.
So you got 2 more
really
years.
Poor choice.
You're gonna bottom out.
I'm almost to the
You're almost to the bottom, but then after that, it's just like you bounce.
Then
you know?
Does my glory story begin? Or
then it
then
begins.
You get a convertible.
Then it begins.
Yeah.
That's right. I can't wait for you to ascend.
Sarah, what about you? Any when you're 20s, did you have a crisis of?
That's what so when you were saying a crisis of faith,
I think something happened here, maybe at the conference.
I remember being in seminary and wanting wanting to quit. And that's like just being like, this isn't, this version of ministry is not interesting to me. It's demanding too much of me. It's expecting too much of me. And it's not, it doesn't have anything to do with what God, I mean, God doesn't need anything from me. So why are we talking about how we need to be doing all these things? And that was such a huge shift from, you know, the faith I'd grown up with and the faith I was sort of receiving. Mm. So, yeah, I mean, I think that was a big crisis point. I mean, I'm from Mississippi, so like we get married as soon as we graduate from our like our undergraduate degree. So I would say in terms of like a crisis in that way, I'm not sure that's happened. Maybe that'll happen.
Well, it's definitely become a thing.
Yeah.
The quarter-life crisis. In fact, this first...
like late 20s?
I think it's
30s?
Late 20s. I think it's
end
mid to late 20s.
Secondary adolescence.
It's really post-college.
Yeah.
What's it all about?
Yeah.
Who am I?
Uh-huh. That makes
young,
sense.
Like early adulthood. So this is from The Atlantic from this past week, which is an article by Maggie Mertens about the new quarter-life crisis. She writes this, TikTok and Instagram are filled with videos of 20-somethings filming themselves running and showing off slick gear as they train for what some call their quarter-life crisis marathon.
Oh.
Yep. Yes.
And offline, more young people really have been running marathons in recent years. In 2019, only 15% of people who finished the New York City Marathon were in their 20s. By 2023, that share had grown to 19%. The same is true in Boston. She says this. She says, setting out to run 26.2 miles is intense.
A terrible idea. I'll never.
But it also promises a profound sense of control that may be something especially appealing to those coming into adulthood. For many of today's 20-somethings, the traditional markers of maturity, marriage, kids, a stable career, home ownership, have become harder to reach. Mm. So when other big life milestones seem elusive, a marathon, though extreme, could feel like a surer route to finding meaning. If you stick to your training plan, this is a goal you can reach. Grace Lee, a 29-year-old in New York, started going on long runs around the city after her social media business foundered at the start of the pandemic. I felt like running was the only thing I could control, Lee told me. In terms of mileage, I could keep going, I could stop. Mertens goes on to say, quarter life is a real, often difficult developmental stage. You move from a highly structured existence, likely in school or living with your family, to a more open-ended one. In recent years, this period of unsettledness has become elongated. The median age of first marriage keeps going up. The median age of first-time motherhood is 30, the highest ever recorded. They're also less likely to feel connected to others or to be involved in, yes, religious and other organizations, and more likely to be lonely. So for some young people, marathons have become a coping mechanism. I mean, from where I'm standing, like, or sitting, if you're looking for a coping mechanism, I just feel like there's a lot...
You could do worse.
More pleasant ones, in fact. I think you could better,
yeah.
Though.
It's better than drinking, but not...
Yeah, is it? It's better than drinking.
Yeah.
I recommend nostalgia.
Yeah.
Garbage Pail Kids. But I don't know... I have seen this, and the amount of 20-somethings that we have fellows at our church, and they're almost, you almost take it for granted that they're all training for marathons. Like, become a thing. But I was talking to Jacob Smith the other day in preparation for this conference. I said, what are you doing? He's like, well, actually, I'm on my training plan right now. I'm prepping for my 9th marathon.
Jacob Smith.
Now, he's
run.
Not in his 20s.
Wow.
No, he's not.
Yeah, I mean, how that guy has done 9 marathons is a little
that's wild.
Confusing. But I love you, Jake.
Maybe he's lying.
Maybe he's lying. Do you see this, though?
Are your boys running?
No, but they were. I mean, Jackson, our oldest, works out a lot.
Yeah,
and my wife works out a lot.
Yeah.
And they're all generally healthier. I do not work out. I will never work out. I hate working out. But I think I escaped. I remember definitely the feeling when I graduated college of feeling like everyone feels this way, like the bottom drops out.
Yeah.
Right. Like, and I had a little older friend say, "Well, that makes sense. Like your whole life, you've been told you can do whatever you want to do, and now you don't know what the hell to do,
mm-hmm. yeah.
and you have no structure left." And I remember watching The Graduate right about that time, which I always recommend to people who are graduating, because it actually captures, you know, the Dustin Hoffman 1967, it captures the angst of graduating from college really well. But then I also got married at 23.
Yeah.
And we had, and then we moved to New York, and we, the towers fell. We had Jackson when we were like 25, 26, and it was like we were off and running. But I do remember when we worked for that youth ministry for Focus, Mark Choi ran a marathon. He's like, I will never do that again.
Yeah.
You know, our friend Kate ran a marathon. She discovered later that she actually had broken a bone in her foot on like mile five, and she finished anyway because she's super hardcore. Mm. I knew a guy in Houston who did ultra marathons, like 50 miles.
That's a mental diagnosis.
Well, he said it was crazy. Well, he was a very driven, high energy guy, demanding career, three kids. But he would go out and he would talk about the hallucinations.
No.
He would have...
No. They are so much easier ways to have hallucinations.
Character.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then and triathlons, too, are big. I'm training for a half Ironman. I'm like, that sounds awful.
I don't hear as much about triathlons these days as I hear about marathons.
Okay.
Sarah, what about you?
I'm here for this just because I think, like, let the young guns do it. I don't understand why people are doing it who are not in their 20s. Like, yeah. That's wild to me. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I do understand the impulse of control. Yeah. I also think about belonging because there is such a culture around running. Yeah. My mom ran a marathon when she turned 50.
Good for her.
Yeah, she ran the Chicago Marathon. And I know a huge part of it was just like the company of doing it with other people. So I wonder if it is just a sense of like a group that you feel like you're a member of and you all have like a common goal. And I don't know.
I'm trying to think of things in my life that I do that because I feel like I can control them.
Mm.
You know, the thing which comes to mind, which is stupid, but I feel like a lot of dads do this. There's that time when like everyone's finally asleep and you just stay up too late.
Yeah.
Because it's like you want an hour or two just to watch what you want to watch and do what you want to do and not having anyone tell you what to do.
And then it's like 2 a.m. and like you're watching Fargo.
Whatever. Yeah. Maybe. Yeah. You know, or The Chosen. You know, one of those. Have you seen The Chosen?
Please don't tell me are you up until 2 a.m. to watch The Chosen,
when I started watching
RJ,
season one, absolutely.
You and I are not the same.
I did. But Fargo also. Fargo season five or whatever. And you're really tired the next day, but it was not a good choice, but it was totally worth it because you don't control anything. You feel like from the moment you wake up and, you know, to the moment when your kids go to bed, which is like a 15-hour span of time, like your life doesn't belong to you. So,
Yeah.
I mean, I want to sympathize because I think that there is so much out of control that Mertens talks about, but it's too... You know, the economy going crazy, the political sphere.
Yeah, it's terrifying.
Know, for some people who, you know, the church sphere implodes in all sorts of ways. I get that. Some of my favorite writing on our site has been, who's actually a writer who's here, Grace Leuenberger, has written about running and the way that is kind of a spiritual endeavor, but also it does become part of your identity. And then what do you do when you can't run or you get injured? So it's a...
It takes
I just
a toll
don't
on
think
your body.
I saw it coming that the marathon itself would become such almost a. Remember that picture of top of Mount Everest? Remember from a few years ago where it was completely crowded at the top of Mount Everest?
Just a line of people.
When I was a kid, I remember thinking marathons, that was very rare. There was like an extreme thing, and now it's sort of everyone does it. And if we're chasing awe? Right, because I think that's part of what you're chasing control, but you're also they talk about when you finish a marathon, you've never felt such pride, but you're also there's like transcendence as well as belonging,
and your body is just like screaming.
Yeah. But if everything's accelerating too, and that's part of what is we've talked about it, like in terms of like contemporary life, what's next?
Yeah.
Because once it becomes pedestrian to have
triathlon.
Triathlon?
Yeah, that's okay. Nice. That's the next. That's the next.
Good to know.
Step. And then,
Well, this next piece kind of hits the nail right on the head, and it's by someone we've talked about before. It's Catherine Jezer Morton writing in The Cut, her brooding newsletter. She wrote this wonderful thing, a column called Parenting Through Our Control Issues. She writes this. She says, control is the spirit of our age. It's everywhere, embedded in everything. Sometimes we experience it as convenience, like how we get to tweak our Sweetgreen and Starbucks orders until they are just right, or customize our Amazon devices so they anticipate our needs. Other times we experience control as stats, like our step count, heart rate, the rings on our fitness trackers, our weekly phone report, or the number of books we read per year. Then there's the control of surveillance, the rings, the nests, the Find My Friends. It's why I ask an app how to get somewhere I've been to 100 times in case there might be some unexpected traffic. She says this, control culture starts with consumer choices, but it has bled into our expectations for how other people should behave and into how we raise our kids. We co-regulate with our children and carefully define boundaries with our friends. We control intakes and outcomes, and we hardly even notice when we're doing it. The search for control is so complete in our lives that we take it for granted. Life feels exhausting when everyone is obsessed with maintaining control, but no one is calling it that. And parenting today is, by every measure, exhausting. Hmm. She then spells out some specifics. She says, in babyhood, parental control begins with the obsessive maintenance of a non-toxic environment, whatever that means to you, and it can mean anything. Food and sleep regimens have always been necessary for parents trying to work and run a household, but today's options for controlling and optimizing your baby's sleep have far surpassed any real utility. It continues into later childhood as kids' social worlds become further sites of optimization. Safety, correct friends and activities, correct schools. When we think about raising children today, it's often less a matter of participating in a shared family culture as 20 years of managing outcomes. What I really hate about the control I feel inside myself and the control I see radiating out of others is that it's making us behave more stupidly than we actually are. It's robbing us of the ability to think imaginatively and with sensitivity about what life is really like. Anxious parents really think that by consuming and communicating with enough intentionality, they can control their children's future, an unharmed childhood giving way to an actualized, thriving adulthood. But any adult who pauses to think about it knows that we always come to regret something about our past, no matter how nice our childhoods were. When we raise our kids with too much control of their moods, their consumption, their safety, we are making it harder for them to transform and change. We get too good at defining what it means to be safe and happy for them. The walls close in. No wonder parenting looks so awful to many non-parents.
That's so funny. I have single friends and I'll like say, oh, well, Annie's doing this or Neil's doing that. And they literally will be like, "This, I would never want to do that. This is why I'm not a parent." Like it feels like parenting like really can affirm non-parenting. I think sometimes you just gotta yell at your kids. Even if you really try to practice co-regulation, which if you don't know what that is, it's like if you have a little kid and they're flipping out, your goal is to like sort of calm them down with yourself and do some breathing and all this stuff. And like sometimes you just can't f-ing do that. And you yell at them. And I did that this week because I was really stressed about this. Josh was out of town. I'm trying to get myself together. And the 13-year-old is like 13-year-olding in my face. And I just like lost it. Yeah. And both kids looked at me like, the hell is this lady? And it took me some time. But one thing that I found really comforting when I have those moments, because I just think that's almost, I think it's necessary. Mm. Like, because conflict exists in the world, but especially because conflict exists in our marriages, conflict exists in our relationships, and so kids have to see that in order to know how to walk through it. And I know it's scary for kids when we yell, like, I'm not trying to downplay that, I get that, but one thing that I found that's very comforting that I've been told is, it's not, and this is Terrence Real, who's like a marriage therapist that Josh and I really love, it's not about if you're gonna have conflict, because you're gonna have conflict, you're gonna yell at your kids, you're gonna yell at your spouse. It's what does the reconciliation look like?
Yeah.
And that, you know, and I was sitting there with my kids thinking like, I'm such a bad mom, you know? not just because we're watching Grey's Anatomy and Annie's nine, but but because I've like scared them a little bit and I've yelled at them, and also like they haven't really done anything except be themselves. And so it was like a moment to just like turn the TV off and be like, hey, I should not have done that. That was too much. But like, it really is about that reconciliation, because you're going to mess up or you're going to be crazy.
So it's more like what happens when you lose control.
Right.
How do you handle that?
Right. Because that's the thing, is there's this, the unspokenness of this need to control is that you won't ever lose control. So then you never have a plan for what to do. Do you know what I mean?
It's just to hold tighter.
Yeah, you're just like, either I have ultimate control or I'm like a terrible human being.
Right.
I've heard people say that too, that like, it's okay for your kids to see you fight as long as they also see you make up. And I've said this before, but you know, profound thing that a friend of mine said to me in high school, because I could tell she really loved her father. And I said, he was a good father. And my father was okay. But I said, you know, what makes your dad such a good father? And she said, well, one thing is he's always willing to apologize to me.
Oh, my God.
You know, he's willing
to
say when he's sorry, when he's blown it. And he was a, you know, wonderful Christian man. But I've never forgotten that.
That's
because
amazing.
Sometimes, even in, especially in Christian circles, there's this thing like, you know, you're the stand-in for God. And
right.
So you need to be perfect. So, no. You're not. You don't bear witness to God by being God. You bear witness to God by being a person who's willing to say that you've blown it. And to ask for forgiveness, and also just to talk about, I mean, I was driving Marshall to school the other day, and I was tired. I'd had a really busy week, and I think Jamie and I just got into a fight right before them, and he's like, Dad, why are you being so mean? And I tried to talk about it, and I actually got a little choked up, because I was just like, Marshall, I'm sorry, I'm just tired. I'm just really tired. It's been a hard week. So I don't know, hopefully that helped out. The other thing I thought...
Or he's just like, I have really old parents.
I've got really old parents, exactly. Yeah. My parents are so old.
Dad, I gotta put the top up on the car for once?
Man, if we had a dollar jar for every time I tell him, like, oh, Marshall, I'd love to, but I'm too tired. Like, we'd have college covered already. But I will say, Jamie at the same time is outside with them every night playing pickleball for like an hour and a half, which is, my wife is amazing. There's this quote which I've heard is Augustine. I haven't found it. This is probably apocryphal. One of you will tell me if this is true or not. It's something like, sin is God's gift to man to break his pride.
Mm.
And that makes me think, like, children are God's gift to parents to break their sense of control.
100%.
You know?
Yeah.
And I think it's like what the pastor who married Jamie and I said. He said, nothing will show you the depths of your selfishness like getting married. Right, like living in relationship with another person. So I think there is something scary about that, but it's just true, and it's embracing it. And I also think, you know, as some of you know, we have two kids in college. One's graduating in like 3 weeks, which is nuts. And, you know, one's a freshman. And then we've got Marshall. And on the one hand, it's like, oh, we were so close to empty nesterdom. You know, like the trips we'd be taking, the money we would have.
They'd be so nice.
That would be so nice. But I also think, I think I might be a little bored. Mm. And it felt too young. Like, I feel like Jamie and I'd be looking at each other being like, well, what now? You know, like, it would almost be, and he loves the waves. You know, we go and he's fearless, and he plays pickleball with Jamie, and like, he drives us totally crazy.
Yeah.
But life is a lot more interesting with him in it. Even if it is a tremendous source of stress, you know, especially like, don't get me started with being a first grade boy in schools today, which are not equipped to handle. You know anything about schools and boys, Dave? Do you know anything about that? Anything about that at all?
Yeah.
So I don't know.
I used to get so frustrated. We're not there anymore, so I'll say this. With our church school and our son. And I said to my husband, who loved it, right? Because he's the minister there. So he's like essentially in charge of the school. So he loved when I would complain
loves
to him
feedback.
About the school. Yeah,
yeah,
loves
please
my
tell
feedback.
Me, tell me how to run this place. Yeah, fantastic.
And I was like, what would be great is if on the sign you could just put a great school for well-behaved girls.
That's what every school should say. That's what every school.
And then it'd be honest,
you know? Yeah. Yeah.
Well, the idea that the job of a parent is actually to control your children rather than to love your children is the great burden under which many of us live.
But if you're paying attention, it can't last that long.
But even if you know intellectually that that's not, I'm not here to manage outcomes. You know, this isn't actually my child, it's God's child. It's very hard not to get completely wrapped up in that, especially when, you know, you're the one telling them when to wake up and picking them up from such and such, which is why I was so touched and encouraged, because my wife and I very much struggle with being the parents who are like late to pick up and, you know, kind of don't really know what's going on this summer. You know, we have some sense that things are going to happen, but we're living in a town where people have planned their summers out like 3 years in advance. Yeah. And it's hard not to take that as a serious judgment.
We're all judging you.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm like, Dave, it's Google, okay?
Dave, I'm not judging you.
Google
we
in a calendar,
either.
Dave.
We have no idea.
Arthur Brooks, writing in The Atlantic, talked about the one big thing you can do for your kids, and it's not, in fact, nagging them or lecturing them or bugging them about their grades or staying on top of them. He says he talks about sort of, most of a child's personality is actually inherited. Most of its sort of nature. That's what it comes out as.
Yes.
And then there's a small variance where parenting style has a little bit of influence. And this is what he writes. He says, in contrast with the possibly limited influence of parenting style on most personality traits, parental behavior does appear to significantly affect the roughly half of children's happiness that may not be genetically determined. Specifically, one factor, parental warmth and affection, with slightly more weight to that of fathers, has been shown to make up about a third of psychological adjustment differences in their children, a holistic measure that includes markers of happiness. So, when you don't know what to do, be warm and loving. For happiness, the parenting techniques that truly matters is warmth and affection. As my wife used to say when we were at our wit's end with our son, I guess we should just love him.
Yeah.
This might sound like a hippie recipe for disaster, but it isn't. Your kids don't need a drill sergeant, Santa Claus, or a helicopter mom. They need someone who loves them unconditionally and shows it even when the brats deserve it the least, especially when they're at their most bratish. So, hey, you know.
100%.
They may not know what they're doing this summer, but I just think they think we love them.
Love them. Yeah.
We fooled them again.
I'm thinking of when Neil was little and would get in trouble a lot in class. And because he was on the campus with Josh's church, they, of course, would call Josh, who was, like, working in his office, to come deal with it. And at one point, we had to come pick him up, and I remember just being so exasperated and talking to Josh on the phone and be like, what are we going to do with him? And Josh goes, we're going to love the hell out of that kid.
Oh.
And, like, that was, like, we picked him up early. It was when I was still working at St. Martin's, and they had a gift shop with not a lot of things for little boys, but they had this little, it was around Christmas time, and they had this little 10 nativity set. Mm-hmm. And I gave it to him. I didn't know what he would do. He put it up in his room. It stayed up in his room until we moved, like on his bookshelf. But it was like, sometimes I actually do think, and I don't think this is gentle parenting. I don't think this is like a psychological thing at all. I really don't. Sometimes I think when the kids are at their worst, I think it's totally theological. And you just like rush them with love. Like, I think that is like, I actually think that is like Christian parenting on some level, right? Like it's like when they don't expect it. And that's the closest maybe we get to emulating God.
Yeah.
Imitation. Yeah.
Bearing witness.
Yeah.
Well, I think
sorry.
I think that creates the space for them also to have some level of self-awareness about what's going on in their own heart and their own mind, like giving them the words, right, to not just lash out, to not just be angry, to not just react, but to be able to, you know, articulate how they're actually feeling. And I've seen that with my own boys, because that's what you want, right? You want to build some self-awareness, some resilience, but yeah, that often doesn't come by just coming up against them. It comes by embracing them when they're hurting and helping them to kind of think that through a little bit.
And just like fun. Like I think about like, there's a song that I saw this wonderful young elementary teacher she does it with her kindergartners, and it's a, she's black, predominantly black group of students, and so they all stand up and they're clapping in this rhythm, and they sing this song. I'm going to sing it for you. It's long. I'm sorry. But it goes like this. So imagine a room full of kindergartners. It goes, it's Friday. It's Friday. It's the end of the week and the last day. And I would say, so Dave, Dave, what you going to say? And you would say, if you were my daughter, you would say, I'm going to get my iPad on. I'm going to get my snuggle on. I'm going to get my snacks on all weekend long. And I saw this and I was like, are my kids too old for this? You know, I mean, I saw this like 6 months ago and I was like, I'm going to give it a shot. And even my 13-year-old, he'll be like, face down in the pillow. And he'll just be like, I'll be like, you're going to get, I mean, it's Friday morning at 7 a.m. You're going to get your, and he'll just be like, Xbox on, you know, like there's something about like the play of that, that is just awesome. That. Yeah.
I think humor is like so important. Yeah. Like Marshall and I have this, I don't know, we've got this running joke now where, I don't know, he'll get frustrated with himself. He's like, why can't I figure this out? He's like, or you know, it's like, well, Marshall, because you're not that smart. You know, or like, you know, you're not very attractive, you're not good at sports, and you're just not very smart. And he's like, yeah, Dad, and you're like, you know, kind of fat and not good at your job.
That's awesome.
It's funny. And then he's like, take me over to Wyatt's house. I want to live over there instead. And I was like, that sounds great. I'll trade you for Dax. He's better than you anyway. That's Wyatt's little brother. Yeah. And then he'll just be like, Dad, you're such an asshole. But like I'm like, Marshall, you can only say that when it's the two of us. You can.
Oh my God, he actually says it. I love this.
Yeah. So yeah. To help him laugh at themselves a little bit. He's so, I don't know where he gets this from.
At all.
Very intense, perfectionistic.
You and Jamie are such free spirits.
We're just like, ooh, yeah. Just
in your blazer.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, he's just like, we see ourselves so much in him. And I just, I couldn't laugh at myself till I was like 20 or something. I can barely do it now.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't want to burden my kids with that. I want the ability to like laugh at yourself, not take yourself so seriously. I think it's such a gift, and just to have fun with them, laugh a little bit, even if you use a little profanity every so often.
Yeah.
You
know? Nothing to lose. I'm looking at that right behind you.
Yeah. Except your relationship with your children.
Yeah. You can lose.
Nothing to lose except for your relationship.
Well, we're going to shift gears entirely from parenting to dating. We haven't talked about dating for ages.
Well, none of us have dated in ages.
Callie wrote about this in the Weekender this past week. There's a new advice column in The Point, which is sort of a literary journal, excellent publication. Lillian Fishman is the columnist, and she was answering, the title is, Can We Ever Trust Ourselves? And someone wrote in to ask this. He says, I've always found dating apps exhausting, but recently they've started to feel pointless as well. The premise of these apps is that based on some photos and a little conversation, we can reliably identify what we're looking for in a partner. The older I get, though, the more I feel like I don't actually know what I want.
Yes.
Mm. Based on who I swipe on and flirt with, I have a distinct type. But those connections have never actually gone anywhere. By contrast, what I remember about the first girl I really fell in love with was how very not my quote-unquote type she was, and how I loved her, if anything, more because of that. My feelings felt all the more authentic because I couldn't explain them. With each failed relationship since then, my distrust of my own romantic intuition has grown. I'm setting up dates with people who, precisely because I think they are a good enough fit to ask out, probably aren't a good fit at all. The only alternative seems to be to give up the whole idea of consciously directing my dating life and to simply wait for the right person to stumble into my life unbidden, but that seems like foolish optimism. Okay, that's the question, right? This is Lillian Fishman's response. She quotes Vivian Gornick, the famous literary critic and feminist, in an interview with the Paris Review. She described a version of this perspective with her trademark lucidity. This is what Gornick writes. She says, "The thing that feminism taught me very quickly was that we were all making instrumental use of each other. That, for instance, when a man was attracted to me, he wasn't attracted to me as such. He was attracted to the feelings I aroused in him. And what he wanted from me was that I keep that arousal alive. That is what we call sexual infatuation, and it's fine, delicious, necessary. But it does not constitute reality between people. The first time a man said to me, "I can't trust you," I said, "What? You can't trust me? That's not the way this works. It's I can't trust you." But he was right to say it. I didn't have his concerns at heart. I had my own. I wanted him to act in a way that would make me feel good more than I wanted to know who he really was or what he really needed. I wanted to be secure. I wanted to be loved. I wanted the telephone to ring. I didn't want him as such. Fishman goes on and interprets this. She says, "This passage always reminds me of a prevalent love logic in our culture. Namely, that love is created and sustained by our being treated well." If there is a single conviction governing American romance right now, I am certain that it's loving someone means making them feel consistently good, making sure they never doubt your commitment, learning how to speak the language of love on their terms. The only love that is culturally condoned right now is this self-interested love. And the reason is, of course, that everyone is petrified in exactly the way you're petrified. We don't know what we want. And in the absence of many of the practical desires that structured partnership for the better part of history, the best approximation we can make about what we should want or what it would be good to want is someone who treats us well and devotes themselves to making us feel good all the time. We are being taught to look for people who can be instrumental to us. We are not encouraged to, quote, apprehend another human being as a separate reality akin to one's own. And it's a lot of words.
So I pulled up this quote that I loved from Joseph Campbell. "A love affair has to do with immediate personal satisfaction, but marriage is an ordeal," which makes me think of Revelations, like those are the ones who have been through the great ordeal. It means yielding time and again. That's why it's a sacrament. You give up your personal simplicity to participate in a relationship. And when you're giving, you're not giving to the other person, you're giving to the relationship. And if you realize you are in the relationship just as the other person is, then it becomes life building, a life fostering and enriching experiences. This is the challenge of a marriage. I loved that quote because it does feel really, marriage feels so foreign to dating now in a lot of ways. I mean, I tell Josh all the time that if he dies, I'm just gonna sleep on his grave until the Lord takes me, because there's no way. I mean, have you guys seen, I'm sure you've seen the meme that's like, if you dated before dating apps, you basically got out on the last chopper in Vietnam because it's so brutal. The whole experience of, and I have single friends who do these, they do dating apps, they swear them off. They do them, they swear them off. But it feels like the only way people are meeting each other also, because I have a lot of friends who are married from these apps. But it feels more and more disembodied. And I'm also terrified it's going to be the only way our kids meet people, you know? Not to be a bummer. But
go to church.
Go to church, especially if you're a man. There's a lot of women there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So many women. Yes.
Lots of girls.
Yeah.
I've told you guys what Jamie said if I die, right?
What?
She's like,
going to remarry immediately?
No. She's like, "This has been great. I love you. I'm done. That's it. It was great." But she's like, "RJ, if I die, give it 6 weeks. Please give it a good
memorial."
Oh, you mean she's done with relationships
and
of all time
totally. Being married? She's like, "I'm fine. Yeah. I'll do my own thing.
Yeah, she would
I'll
be fine.
Live by. Yeah, yeah, I love you to death. This has been great. She'll be fine. But if I die, RJ, please, just
RJ's
for the sake
just got
of the children."
Line of women up with casseroles, just like, "I've always wanted to marry a Kennedy."
Good. No, men are not good at being alone.
Yeah,
men
not.
Are. Women are much better at being alone than men are being. Okay, it struck me they're so. It was so sad. That was sad to me because there was no sense of like the miracle of falling in love.
Yeah,
like it's a miracle. It just felt very sort of utilitarian. It felt like the response of someone who has given up that they might actually just fall in love with somebody, you know, which I still really, I really do believe in. You know, I feel that way about my wife. Like, she drives me crazy. I drive her crazy. But, like, I am in love with that chick. Mm. And, like, there's nobody else I want to be with. And there is a submission to someone else's. I mean, I thought this before, right? That when, I think I said this, Paul has a whole thing that people hate about submitting to one another out of reverence for Christ. And I've often thought what that means is that when you're married to somebody, you need to be willing to submit to their version of reality, which is not always your version of reality. Yeah. And then even if you're like, you're fully, you know what,
right?
It's like, okay, you need to trust that what they're saying to you and their experience of a particular conflict, like, that was their experience, you know, and that's just to step in someone else, to submit to their thing. But I 100% think it's true that you end up marrying the opposite of who you thought you would be with. You know, I mean, Jamie dated a punk rocker before she met
Poor
me.
Poor Jamie.
I know. Well,
then she married
then
you.
Then she married me. I know. It was a huge... And she said to me when we were dating...
You are not punk rock.
I'm not
like
punk rock.
A lot of things.
I was wearing, like, I was, like, you know, 21. I was wearing, like, some khaki shorts and, like, you know, probably these some
were
shoes like
these.
Were
you still wearing your beret?
Maybe. I don't know. No, that would have been more... And she looked at me. She goes, RJ, at this moment, you're the exact opposite of anyone I ever thought I'd be with.
Mm.
You know?
Well, what we're talking about again is control.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, control and love don't really mix.
No.
I'm going to only date the exact person that I think I need, that you know, that I've dictated to the world and to God that I have to be with, you've really shut out love. I think the
one way it works maybe is when it comes to like physical attraction. And I got to say that, because sometimes Christians, there have been certain Christians, leaders who've taught things like, you know, just marry another Christian and, you know, sexual desire will come later. It's like, will it?
No.
I don't know, you know, like, so I think being attracted to someone, but then as you get to know them, that you know, personality-wise, you end up, like, I thought I wanted to marry a very extroverted, you know, and Jamie's an introvert. But of course, it's you know, if I'd had someone who talks as much as me, it would have been, you know, too much.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It would have been a lot.
But yeah, you can't control.
Any other?
I mean, I'm thinking about this one moment that happened probably 7 or 8 years ago. It was when we were in Houston, and you know, Josh and I had very different upbringings, and a huge part of that difference is I grew up with a lot of resources and he grew up with no resources. And he would do things around it that would just make me absolutely crazy. Like, we are not poor, we have money, we need to, you know, blah, blah, blah. I had this whole sort of narrative, and he would always be like, we don't have that much, you know, I mean, like, it would be this money was a thing that we talked about a lot. And I was in our laundry room and I was reaching up to try to get the detergent, and I pulled it out, it was high, and the cup that comes on the detergent had been filled with water because Josh wanted to make sure that we got that teaspoon of detergent that sits in the bottom of the cup. And it went all over my face. And it was like the first time I got it. Like, this is important for him. This makes him feel safe that we're careful with our resources. And this is a part of who he is. And it's not something that I need to, like, belittle or not take seriously, you know? Like, it's part of loving him is understanding this about him and also seeing it as, like, also a really beautiful thing. It comes out of concern for our household. So, yeah, I mean, I was just saying this to Sarah Beth Zoll, you know, it's just suffering. That's all. That's being willing to suffer together, to figure these things out together, is just super important.
I thought you were about to say, and that's why I wear glasses today.
Yeah, no. Like, thankfully, I wore glasses.
I was blinded by the
detergent. Thankfully, I wore glasses at that point, yeah. But,
oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Well, that's actually a beautiful story because, I mean, money is such a
It's one of the big things. Yeah, it's one of the big things.
And I find that in all the dating stuff that goes on, like, no one ever talks about the things that really... They'll talk about sex as something that matters, but in actual marriages, it feels like people are fighting about money all the time.
Yeah.
And not just, you know, they're just like, you spent such and such on such and such, and why aren't we spending it on this? And that's not something you ever really think about until you're married. and it's certainly not something...
Money is a thing.
But what is money if not a form of control?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, let's move on to something a little more uplifting. This is from Tony Robinson. Wonderful Tony Robinson. He wrote this on Mockingbird. He's not here this weekend, but sends his regards. He'll be here next year. And it is a article called Seven Words That Sum Up the Entire Bible. Tony was talking about traveling to a church that was sort of an inner city church like this, but like a huge old mainline church that had really died and then was coming back. It had gotten down to like, it had a sanctuary that held 1,200 people and they were having 50 on a Sunday. Mm-hmm. But this church was starting to get a couple hundred, then 200, 300, 400 people on a Sunday. And Tony asked what the senior warden, what accounted for that, or the head of the congregation. And he said, well, we have a wonderful new pastor. He has gotten us reconnected to the community, the neighborhood, which is changing. And he's gotten us back into the Bible, into God's word. He gives an excellent Bible study. In fact, he can summarize the Bible's whole message in just seven words. I had, of course, to ask, and what are the seven words that summarize the entire Bible? He smiled and said, I am God and you are not. Mm. Honestly, I had expected something a little friendlier. Yet in an age when we are accustomed to being reminded of our unlimited potential, of our capacity to accomplish or become anything we conceive or imagine or to which we put our mind, I am God and you are not seemed an unlikely mantra for church growth or revitalization. But then I thought of my friend in AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, John. John keeps a post-it note on his refrigerator. It says, there is a God, John, and it's not you. I guess that too could sound deflating or diminishing, but that's not how John took it. Mm-hmm. He heard it as a great relief, as good news. It wasn't all up to him. He wasn't and didn't have to be in control of everything. He could let God be God for him. So too for a congregation whose past greatness may have become a crippling burden. Yeah. Not only do golden eras turn into golden handcuffs in a subsequent era, but they tend to make us think that we have been the active agents in the story of redemption. We become the subject of the verbs in such a story of church greatness. But in Scripture, that's not how it is. We are not the subject of the verbs, nor are we the active agent in the salvation story. God is. While on another more recent speaking gig, I met the pastor of another church that had dwindled to nearly nothing but was now experiencing new vitality. I said, I'd like to visit your church. And she said, do come, we'd love to have you. Then she said, come and see what God is doing. Mm. There it was again. God, the subject of the verbs. God as an active agent. Jesus up to something in the world. I realize that were I inviting someone to my church, I would likely to make us the subject of the verb, saying something like, you'll like our church, we're very warm and friendly. Or, our church is very active, lots going on. Her framing seemed far more interesting and frankly inviting. Come and see what God is doing. As with the seven words that sum up the message of the entire Bible, it's less about us and more about God, which is another way of speaking of grace. Grace, as a friend reminded me recently, is shorthand for God is the active agent in the story of salvation.
That's really good.
Yeah, Tony's awesome.
That's really good.
What do you... God is the, who's
do you feel like God's in charge of your church? Or do you feel like RJ's running?
I hope so. If not, I'm in bad shape. Yeah, it just makes me feel how life can feel really fraught and like your decisions really matter, and you better make the right decision. You better choose wisely, and that could even be true in your Christian life. And I remember a time in my life I was trying to make a very difficult decision about my career, about my faith, where I was going to go. And Jonathan Adams, chairman of the board, said, who I love, said, "Well, RJ, you can't make a wrong choice, because whichever way you choose, Jesus will be there to meet you. It's not like he's looking down, waiting, like, ooh, what's Archie going to do?
Yeah.
You know, am I going to stick with him, or am I going to go this way? You know, am I going to go the other way and abandon him because he makes the wrong choice? But this idea that there's a God and you're not him, it just brings with it such peace and freedom, and also the ability to take some risks, to take some chances, you know, to not feel like it's all riding, to have some fun, to play a little bit, you know? And I can say that I think even as someone who's like leading a church, like we by the grace of God have like taken some chances, because we're like, hey, you know, what you know, if God is for us, who can be against us? You know, as it says in Romans, let's just do our best to be faithful and to just make the best, most prayerful choices we can and count on God for the rest. And so far, he's like been unbelievably faithful. And it's like the more you trust him and the more you step out and the more you play, I feel like the more he shows himself to be good. And then people start to see that he actually is real and it's not just a head trip. You know, it's not just something we say. It's like, oh, maybe he's really there. Maybe he's really with us. You know, maybe I'm not so alone in the world, and I don't need to be so scared all the time and so stressed out and seeking to control everything.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, that's what I think. What do you think, Sarah?
I had this weird flash, and it may be because I'm in New York, and we used to be at a church in Westchester County in a small town. And I remember when we first took that job, there was our church, there was the Episcopal church, and there was a Methodist church that was just down the street. And we're rolling into town, and I have, you know, a lot of ego. Life has not crushed me yet. And I was like, we're going to take those Methodists down. And then, like, 3 years later, the Methodist church closed.
Oh.
And it was so sad. And I remember being this incredible couple came in who, like, basically would be in these churches as they were closing. I mean, they described themselves as like hospice for these churches. And we had them over for dinner, and they were just like, God is going to do what God is going to do. And it was such a comfort. And I say that to a room full of people that I'm assuming I know, actually, because I've already met two colleagues of mine, Episcopal priests here. Like, that has been of great comfort to me over the years when we've had seasons in our churches that have just been a nightmare. And it's like, where is this going to go? What's going to happen? It's like, well, we're not in charge, you know, at all. We're not in charge. This church will still be here long after we're not, you know, and it was here before we were. And God is going to do what God's going to do. And I think people are afraid of that, because that's true in everything in our lives, right? That's not just church. That's everything in our lives. People are afraid of that because A, right, it says we're not in control, but B, I think there's some, especially American perception of laziness, like, well, you're not doing enough, you're not doing the thing, and it's like, that's just anxiety. That's not real. So I also want to say, it reminds me of a thing you always say that I love. We're just playing with house money. You know?
Yes, but Sarah, I'm so glad you said that, because, I mean, some of you know that Dave and I, how long ago was that? 2008, right?
2006, 2007, 2008,
yeah. You moved here to start Mockingbird.
Yeah.
I moved here to plant a church. Even when I came, I said, well, I hope I'm here forever in New York, but maybe I'm just here to come and fail so that I can be okay moving somewhere else. Mm. And that's actually what happened, right? I had 4 years. Some of it was really good. A lot of it was really hard. But I remember also sitting in, it's called Irving Place. Is that breakfast spot is still here?
Yeah.
And I felt like our life was falling apart. Mm. And that song by Pete Drogue that I'd never heard before came on. It's a secular song. It's not a Christian song, but it's called "Going Whichever Way the Wind Blows." And the chorus is "Going whichever way the wind blows, let it go. It will get easier. Let it go. Just enjoy the ride." And I just like, you know, it just, I lost it, because I felt like, I mean, Jesus says that in John 3, right? Everyone's born of the Spirit, The Spirit blows where it chooses, where it comes from, where it's going. Nobody knows. So it is with everyone born of the Spirit, like this crazy Christian life. And just life in general, God's going to do what he's going to do. And sometimes it really sucks, and it's unbelievably painful. But he is God, and we are not. And he'll be with you, right? He doesn't promise it's going to be easy, and it's going to go according to plan, but he will be with you, whether you're in a season of, like, fruitfulness or a season of, like, suffering and pain,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I was just thinking about how if we both got here at the same time and both started things, I won.
You did?
I won.
Although you had to move to
I mean, you're not still here,
Pony
out boy.
Of New York City.
Fair enough.
Move to, Mr. Jefferson City.
What I'm hearing, though, is that the fruit of control in parenting is the same as the fruit.
Jacob Smith won. I just want to say
Jacob
for the record.
Smith.
Jacob Smith won. That's who won.
And now he's doing a marathon.
And now he's doing and climbing roofs.
Yes.
So, yeah.
We hate you. the fruit of control is the same in parenting as it is in dating, as it is actually in religion.
Yeah.
And it's exhaustion.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's breakdown. And it is often, as you said, it's sort of God gives you children to break your sense of control. And my dad always once said, I said, life is one long assault on your sense of control.
Yeah.
And that's what life often feels like. And I think, but as Christians, the place we have somewhere to go after that. We believe that God actually is in control despite, you know, I think that's where faith, if God is after faith and not after success, then coming to the end of our control is not a bad thing because it usually spells the beginning of faith. I was teaching a class last night about why did Jesus die, and we were talking about the forgiveness of that is sort of embodied on the cross. And this wonderful woman said, we talked about, when have you ever actually forgiven a person? Because it feels like a miracle when forgiveness happens. We know it happens, but it feels like a miracle. She said, you know, I have forgiven people, but it's usually been when I've finally gotten too exhausted of the resentments I'm carrying.
Yes.
Mm. When the resentments and the anger, the grudge I'm holding has finally exhausted me.
From my cold, dead hand.
From my cold, dead hand. And at that point, real forgiveness has happened.
Yeah.
But it wasn't, control had to be given up by, it's like once the desire, or once the pain of the holding on to the grudge finally is exceeds the pain of letting it go.
Yeah,
that's when forgiveness happens. Mm.
It's my favorite verse about control and freedom. Romans 8, the creation was subjected to futility, not of its own will, but of the will of the one who created it, in the hopes that we would be liberated from our bondage to decay and enter into the glorious freedom of the children of light.
Mm.
Right? That God set up the world and our lives to be futile and to broken and, you know, not because he's a jerk, but because he's trying to liberate us from our addiction to control and help us enter into the only real freedom there is, which is the freedom of saying that he is God and we are not. So.
Amen to that. But I know that's all the time we have for that. Glad you're here. We'll
talk
to you
y'all.
Soon.
Thanks, y'all. Thanks for being here.
You.
Thank you for listening. Remember, you can find us on the web at www.embird.com. And we'd always love to hear from you at info@embird.com. Audio production for The Mockingcast is provided by TJ Hester. And if you like what you've heard, please drop over to iTunes and leave us a rating or review. Until next time.
Praise the Lord.